Speaking of reliability. Friends talking about reliability engineering topics. Let's discuss how to create and improve your reliability program and your career.
Welcome to Speaking of Reliability. This is Fred Schenkelberg.
And this is Chris Jackson. And we were talking about a scenario that often happens when we go into an organization or a company and we say, hey, these are some things you should try doing to make your device or product or system more reliable. And we always seem to get that one person or one group of people who say, yeah, but how do we know when to stop? What if we make it too reliable? What if we invest too much money in making things reliable? And the reality is, I think you agree with me, Fred, we have never come across an organization or company which has accidentally made things so reliable that it turned out to be a bad thing. It's just not one of those things you should be afraid of.
Well, you know, the more I think about it, I think the auto industry, or let's use the cell phone, right? If we made the cell phone drop proof, mm-hmm. right? One scenario for doing that is put bubble wrap around it so that you could drop it from 35 feet and a little parachute would deploy and then not, you know, it would offload all the data and it would be completely shatterproof and waterproof and everything else. And, but in order to handle those edges of all of those environmental uses, it would weigh 400 pounds and it mm-hmm. costs $3 million. Right. And if you, that's the kind of scenario I hear from people is that, well, what if we want to make it that reliable to work in all those circumstances, then we have to do all these amazing things that most customers really don't want. And so the argument then follows that, well, we're over designing it for the edge cases. That's kind of the logic I hear when somebody says, well, what if we make it too reliable?
Yeah. Well, I think we could categorize these people into two groups. One who are thinking about the design of the system. That is, yes, it's going to have to weigh 5 kilograms or 20 pounds or what have you to make it as reliable as I'm hearing you tell me it needs to be. The other one is the time and effort one. We got a finite amount of time in development. How do we know if we're just wasting money if it's not going to get additional sales or whatever their argument is. Mm-hmm. And I think the reality is you have an organization which doesn't have a clue about reliability. And then you don't just emigrate into a space where you do things and make reliable products, but don't do it in an informed way. There's none of those. That's not the next step. The next step is you actually understand what we often say is the fatal few versus the trivial thousands. Right. So that there's never a phase where you're just indiscriminately doing reliability things that add little to no value. You move from a space where you typically are terrible at it and you're not doing it very well through to, no, we're targeting our improvement. There's no alternate step, even though it seems like that could be very feasible for people who haven't gone on that journey. And that the mobile phone or smartphone industry, I think, is a good example because they, compared to many other industries, they have a pretty good handle on what it is that's going to fail on their phones.
Yep.
And they have reliability goals which are appropriate for the technology, for the technological refresh. We're not saying make things infinitely reliable, but they are informed in terms of trade-offs between design considerations, customer expectation, in a way that most of the people, a lot of the clients that we deal with simply are not. You just don't get those questions in those organizations which have a good reliability model, know what's going to fail, know what needs to be done to take it to the next level.
Yeah. You know some of this, the pushback we get, well, you're going to make it too reliable. And it to me, it comes from I think it's Mill Handbook 785. I think it's like the guidebook for reliability programs and plans, which lists basically every tool you can think of.
Exactly.
right? And every and then there's a 810, which has 47 different tests. I think I've lamented on it before, is I've never got to do the ballistic shock test. That's the only one I haven't done on that site. But I've evaluated products for fungus exposure, for fire ants, for drop testing, you know, water, rain, you know, dust, other kinds of cool stuff. Even had to brew up some artificial sweat one time, but that's a subject for another podcast. But there's tons of information out there about all the things that we could do. And we've run into that as organizations that do, well, that's the standard. Let's do a bunch of that stuff. And then maybe one or two of those activities for a particular program are actually useful. But I find that they're then way too busy doing everything to pay attention to anything that's useful. It becomes a checklist. We did that test. We did that test. Mm-hmm. Will anybody look at it? Anybody use it? No. Right. That's part of that. If you're in a mindset where you're already spending a lot of money doing lots and lots of activities and getting little to no ROI on it, well, then it stands to reason that why would I invest more in reliability work or the design of our product? Because we're not seeing an ROI or return on this as it is. So that's their experience. And then somebody walks in and says, well, what if you did this? It's a halt test. We're going to take three of your samples, three of your prototypes and destroy them. And we're going to learn a lot. And you make your product more reliable. Well, it's the same kind of logic we hear is then, well, why would you want to overstress it that much? Of course it's going to break. Why are we designing it to survive that? Mm-hmm. And it's just goes back to that understanding of how does your customer use your product? What are the highest risks for failures from your materials or from use conditions or the environment or whatever? And then let's focus on making that robust and incrementally make that better. It's not that we need to avoid and make it 100% reliable or five nines reliable for a phone, for example, a consumer device, because that's not expected. If I dropped it off a three-story building or ran over it with a steamroller, yeah, I probably would not expect my phone to work.
Yep. But there's the concept of fake hustle too. I'm glad you raised that scenario. But for those listeners who aren't familiar with the term of fake hustle is something you do when you want to be seen to be doing work or be seen to be putting in effort. Fake hustle, and one of the key characteristics of fake hustle is there's no output or no benefit for doing it that way. We were just listening to a conversation regarding some football coaches, how some commentators were suggesting that fake hustle is prevalent culturally, where you're trying to be the last one to leave the office. You want to spend more time sleeping overnight in your office than the next guy just to put on this facade that you are more committed or you're investing more effort. But that is, when you use mill handbooks, those damn documents have done more to promote this fake hustle and this reliability engineering industry, because it's just checklist after checklist of activity after activity, but they don't influence the design in a positive way. They're exhaustive, these checklists. So every spare resource has to be dedicated to just passing the checklist. You don't have time to think about redesigning the system in a good way.
Yeah, and how to apply those tests. I mean, we've talked about that before, is if you're going to spend money on a like an FMEA or a HALT test or an environmental test, or you're going to do a beta program with customers, if that's not actually connected back to something that you're going to make a decision on and take action on one way or the other, if it's not providing useful information for you to move forward, mm-hmm. Well, then don't do it.
Exactly.
It's a waste of time.
And reliability engineering isn't over-engineering. I think that's a very easy thing for people to dismissively throw at you, as you say, this is what you need to do, or accuse you of potentially being that single issue zealot, that reliability guy who says we must do reliability stuff. But you talked about HALT. HALT is cheap, inexpensive. And what does it do? It lets you know what you need to do to essentially fix the biggest problem that your product is facing, which means it's a targeted approach. You are essentially investigating, doing an analysis, doing something which tells you, hey, if you're going to do one thing, it needs to be this. It's none of this indiscriminate, let's try and change this, do that, and just see what happens. Far from it.
Right.
And it comes back to that point. I've never seen an organization go, damn, we actually created something that was too reliable. We didn't need to do all those things. It never happens because reliability DFR activities are intrinsically investigative. It's just not just bolt this here, it's not weld that there, it's not put the second capacitor over. It's not. You actually, first thing you need to do is try and understand those vital few. There's no organization I've ever walked into which is either completely illiterate or informed about their reliability activities. There's a continuum between those two. There's no third category, which is, oh, we just tried everything and we made it too reliable. Never once seen that happen.
Well, I almost ran into that once. There's the guys, and I've talked about these guys before because I thought what they did and how they put it together was brilliant. They make the scanners for the luggage tags on an aircraft, right? The little handheld scanners that as they take bags off the plane, they scan them. And as they put bags on the plane, they scan it down at the loading, the cargo. And if you ever are brave enough to watch those guys do it, one, you see your bag get dropped and kicked and run over and falls off the cart and stuff like that. But they throw those scanners around and they get banged and bumped into their equipment and they get tossed into the back of their truck. They get dropped on the tarmac. So this group that was designing these things knew it anecdotally, and I think they actually just went out to the airport and watched them for a couple of days, how they handled bags. They thought, wow, we're going to give them electronics with Wi-Fi and a barcode reader on it and stuff like that. We better make it drop proof a little bit. So they went to a standard, the drop standards, right, for handheld equipment. And it was drop it 3 times on each of the faces, each of the corners, each of the sides. And so they did that and they failed miserably. Their equipment just fell apart. So they redesigned it and it passed that test. Great. We got it. We passed this standard. And it was 3 feet onto concrete. Concrete because they're at the airport. They're on the tarmac. I don't know why they call it tarmac. It's concrete, isn't it? Most of the time. Yeah. It's an Air Force thing, airline thing.
Yeah.
So anyway, they thought, oh, we got it in the bag. This is great. They roll it all out. And, you know, within a week, every unit they had in this pilot at one airport failed.
Right.
Because of shocks and bangs and crashes and stuff like that. And they were flabbergasted. So the reliability guy said, well, let's go to 6 feet. Or instead of just 3 drops, let's drop it until it fails. So he was essentially doing a halt. Mm-hmm. Let's find out where and why it fails. Is it accumulated damage? Is it an overstress damage? Is it components coming loose? Let's find out exactly why it's failed. And now they had units to diagnose from the ones that failed. They gave them some clues, but they, over a period of 2 years, they ended up dropping them hundreds of times. Their standard, before they could release a design, would be dropping it hundreds of times from 20 feet. And they would pass that. And then they found that it would survive a year in the baggage handling industry.
Right.
Right. So they started with a standard and thought they had it. And I think that approach was, and you could hear the argument, the design guy saying, well, do we need to make it more than that? No, here's the standard. Let's just pass that standard and we'll be good. If anything else we do, we'll be over design. Now, they had that pretty quick turnaround, iterative process back to their customers where they learned as they went, well, that's not good enough. Let's increase the criteria until they got an acceptable measure of their designs that related to their field experience. And I think that was the brilliant part, is they paid attention to that correlation between what they were doing to qualify their designs to what the stresses that their products were actually seeing in the field.
And I think there are two psychological scenarios here. There are those people who don't want to change, and those people who want to.
No, those people never exist. There's none of them out there. Nah, and that can't be.
That's true. I've heard of these beasts. These are people who are so set in their ways that they've been there since the age of the dinosaurs, and they know everyone and everyone knows them. And they have, you know, their entire families worth photographs from, you know, infant through to teenager up on their cubicle wall. I have never heard of these guys existing, but apparently they're out there. Those people
there's a few.
Don't want to change. And the other group is the people who are just don't want to have the customer affect their life. That is, they want to get their design done as quickly as possible. And if they can have a standard which they can then defendably come back and say, look, I did my job, it passed this standard, I'm going to bed.
Yep.
they don't think about the customer and to the extent that it might make their life slightly more challenging. If they're not thinking about the customer, then they're thinking about themselves, which means I want to get my job done as quickly as possible and then move on. And that's where people cling to these standards without actually thinking about anything. They don't want to have to do the first principles thought process and say, you know what, the standard says this, but we actually have a very hostile environment where you really need to know if it's going to work in this space. And the example you put forward was an organization which certainly didn't overshoot reliability by not doing anything. They certainly weren't anywhere near where they needed to be. And the drop test gave them information to target reliability effort. They weren't just welding additional things or adding shock absorbing material without doing an investigation. They were actually learning about what they needed to do.
Yeah, and to be fair, and these guys did modeling, they did all kinds of work, and they were pretty sophisticated overall. Mm-hmm. Now, they did due diligence on circuit boards and, you know, die attach and all these other things that they were bringing into the system. Yet they found that the focus through the drop, in that marketplace, that was their dominant stress. Now, don't extrapolate this to take your desktop computer and drop it from 20 feet and think you got to pass that. It's what they did was understand that relationship between the stresses that their product was seeing in the field, which was very, very hard to accelerate, and started building a correlation to make that work for them. But it goes back to really understanding what your customer expectations are in their use environment and how that translates into creating failures within your product, and then design those out. Design work incrementally to design those to be more and more robust. But they were a shining example of, I think, getting it right.
Yeah, yeah.
And they were not afraid to change. It took them a while to come over to get past that and get past the guy that had been there forever. And this is how you design these things. But they were able to put the data together. They provided concrete information back to the design teams to make improvements, and they proved it to themselves over and over again with their field trials. The other attitude, though, of I just want to get it done. I mean, there is institutional pressure. It's not just I don't think it's driven solely by the individuals, although there are folks that are that way. You know, give me the standard and I know what to do, and don't change it as we go. I can understand that, but there's plenty of pressure in organizations to lower cost of the final design, to time to market, get it done on time. And those become incentivized, right, and drive a majority of decisions. And if that balance with the reliability isn't there, then it gets run over, right? So I see institutional pressures that drive that behavior, not so much the individual's choice to do that.
Well, I might challenge that to an extent, because it's the individual who's in charge, isn't it? It's a leadership management thing. So I know what you're saying. It's not the coal face engineers necessarily implementing manifesting this desire to want to get it done before they move on. In fact, nine times out of ten, they would prefer to work as long as it would take to get a working product. If they want to get it done and then go to bed, it's usually driven from above, where you have deadlines to meet, goals to meet. You have VPs and directors who where the organization internally internally rewards them for being on time, under budget, all those sorts of things.
Right.
But they're the individuals that we're talking about here. So you have those people who don't want to change and those people who don't want to listen to the customer because it's all about them. It's all about what they want to do. I would argue that mm-hmm. really good engineers, if you say, look, you know, you take them out of one sort of toxic environment and put them in another, and provided that they're fundamentally good engineers, and you say, look, what we're going to do now is make sure we design it right the first time, not design it as quickly as possible, they will tend to adapt. It's that there is a desire to please your boss or please the organization that drives everything. So it comes back to, yeah, but we don't want to change.
Here's the, yeah, I find that we don't want to change is often the harder one. I find and I agree with some of the literature from Henry Petrosky on engineering behaviors. They essentially want to design a reliable product, right? We generally don't want to design a product that just is going to go out and fail and not function and not work for our customers. I think there's an inherent piece in that. It's when the management team takes that for granted. Mm-hmm. Oh, they're good engineers. They'll make a good product. But then you don't give them the time and resources to actually do it or the feedback they need to know if they're doing it. That's when it breaks down. I think there's a big piece of that. The larger challenge is that just the resistance to change. And that comes in all forms. From
exactly.
You want me to move my office two doors down or, you know, two cubicles over? No, I can't handle that. That's too much stress. To we're going to use CAD systems now versus pencils. Remember some of the arguments on that. Even computers were a big change for people.
Cars and vehicles are a big change for people.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, walking upright. I remember that. Yeah,
we're good. Still working on that one.
Yeah. But yeah, it's a good point. Going back to the original thought, though, is one of the things we hear is resistance. Of what if you over-design it? Right? We're going to waste time and resources and energy on it. And I think the caveat is as each of these reliability activities is thought through and adds value to your process, it provides critical information, right, focus and prioritization and so on, that it adds value. It doesn't add to the checklist, mm-hmm. right? That I think is pivotal to know that you're making a product that's reliable enough to meet or exceed your customer's expectations. And it is, if you end up making a product that is head and shoulders more reliable than any of your competitors, seriously, that's a bad thing, right? If it's just obvious that it's so much more reliable, that's what created the laser printers and HP calculators years ago, and the old test and measurement equipment that they made was so rock solid. They charged a premium for it because it was so reliable. Now, there was still internal pressure to make it reliable enough, right? But it was just a higher bar. There's lots of advantages to making it reliable.
Exactly.
It's spoken as a true reliability engineer, right?
Well, I mean, at no stage do you or I or anybody else who's in this space suggest we just throw money away or just or blindly do this activity or make this design change without investigating it further. I think the first thing I advocate is things like Vermeers and Holtz and analyses, because you don't know until you actually use critical thought. And that's a key concept, I think. If we come back to that guy who sits in the back of the room and says, yeah, but how do you know if we're investing too much money into it? And the answer is the answer contains a number of thoughts. One is, I've never seen it happen. Two is, how do you know you're investing enough right now? You could really take that argument down in every single conceivable way, the most important being, will the customer want to buy it?
Yep. Very true. All right. So I expect next week we're going to hear about the $5,000 phone that's encased in bubble wrap and stuff like that. Or in batteries that are lead acid batteries on a cart to charge it because they're known not to catch on fire as often.
Right.
You know, things like that. So we'll see what happens. But if you're listening to this and you see this as part of the resistance you get in your reliability program, you know, hey, how do you know you're not going to over design it, or you're doing too much, it's going to be too reliable? You know, what kind of challenges are you facing there? Let us know. Head over to ascendoreliability.com/go/SOR and let us know where, what's happening there, and what challenges you have, or even better, what the success stories you've had, how you've gotten through this process and overcome some of these obstacles and improved your product for your customers. Love to hear from you. So with that, Chris, I'm going to go out shopping for the ultimate, perfect, reliable, always available cell phone that I don't have to carry. I don't have to charge. I don't have to. I'm thinking the little communicator badge on Star Trek. That's what I want.
Then you have to worry about the network coverage.
No, that's all part of the process. That's got to be perfect. Okay. Yeah, it's got to be perfect. Enough. Be 100 balloons above the house all the time. So.
Well, you send me a text when you from that phone when you find it.
All right. Oh, it has to text now too. All right.
Right. Might have to change.
Yeah. Oh, bother. Yeah. My wife just got into Instagram with one of her kids. One of the kids said, well, let's share pictures on Instagram. And so she's moving tentatively into social media now.
It's, right.
It can happen. It can happen.
It can. These things can happen.
Yeah. All right, Chris. Talk to you later.
Thanks for taking the time out. Yeah, absolutely. Looking forward to our next conversation.
All right, cool. Cheers then.
Thanks for listening to Speaking of Reliability. We invite you to join the conversation. If you have a question or a topic that you think we should discuss in a future show, please let us know. You can find a comment box below the episode show notes, or just leave a note as part of a review on iTunes.